All right, we're going to pick up now in our study in Hebrews, and according to my screen, this is sharing. Okay, is everybody able to see this on the screen and the slides that I've got here? Okay, I see the thumbs up, so it sounds like that it's working. Okay, we're going to be looking at chapter one here and just kind of jump right into the study. One thing is, I think really fascinating about this. We call it the Epistle to the Hebrews, but it really doesn't, it's not written in the style of an epistle. The reason is because at the beginning, there's nothing about who the author is. There's nothing about the audience to which he is writing this. It's more like a sermon. And it really, quite honestly, most of the book until you get to the very last chapter is written more in the style of a sermon. In fact, one commentator said that it is the finest example of Greek oratory that we find anywhere in the New Testament. And it is very much in that style. Clearly the author was well trained in Greek oratory and used that training, as a way that he wrote this wonderful book. It begins with this simple statement. All right. Can you hear me okay now?
Yes, we got you now.
Okay. Sorry about that, Adam. I don't know what happened where I got muted there. Let me just start at the point I was talking about. The first two verses there, it tells us about how God speaks. And what's interesting about this is the fact that the preposition that you would expect to see the word through, is not the preposition that the author uses. Instead, he says that God speaks in the prophets, and then in verse 2, speaks to us in these last days in his son. It says something to us about the nature of how God speaks. It says something about the nature of how God would communicate through, or I should say, in these prophets, and how that God communicates in his son. He says here that long ago, that God spoke to the fathers in the prophets. And specifically here that it shows us the role, the significant role that the prophets had. In the book of Amos, Amos says, God does nothing without revealing his secret to his servants, the prophet. The idea here is that we would know nothing about God if it was not for the message of prophecy, if it was not for God revealing the reason of what he is doing. Deuteronomy 29:29, of course, with the passage we often think about, it says that the secret things belong to God, but the things that are revealed are for us. This is how we understand God. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 that we don't even know the thoughts of man who is just like us, much less how could we know the thoughts or the will of God if he had not revealed it. And so this message of the prophets is not just through the prophets, But in fact, it was in the prophets. The prophets themselves were, even though they were often persecuted by the ones that were sent the message, there still was this sense of respect, the sense of authority for those who were the messengers of God, who would reveal the word of God. And I think that's reflected in this message here of Amos. But then the writer goes on to say that he did so in many portions and in many ways. The word that is translated many portions there, it's actually just one Greek word, poly, and I forgot the last part of that, how that's pronounced, but it really means, and the idea that this was all very fragmentary. God would reveal a portion of the message through a prophet. He would reveal another portion of the message through another prophet. And we're going to see that here in Hebrews chapter 1, because the writer is going to take all of these fragments and assemble it together to make one concise point about the Christ. But he says, and long ago, God revealed these things in many fragments and many parts. But he says, and then he also says that he has done so in many ways. The term here, again, is just one word meaning poly, and it has to do with the various methods that were used for transmitting this message of God. This was, of course, by speech. We know that there were prophets who were just simply given a message from God, and they would speak directly what the Holy Spirit revealed to them. We know that there were visions. For example, Ezekiel talks about the fact that he was taken in a vision in Ezekiel chapter 8 through 11, taken in vision back to Jerusalem, and he revealed to the people the things that he saw in this vision. We know that the prophets also performed many signs. Elijah, for example, was able to bring about a famine in the nation of Israel. This was part of his prophetic action, if you would. And then I mentioned Ezekiel. We go back to Ezekiel in chapter 2 at the very beginning, where God has him to lie down in front of a model of the city of Jerusalem for a period of over a year, every day lying down and setting siege against the city. And this was a message for the people of Israel. God even used a donkey as a prophet. So God used a variety of different methods to reveal these different fragments of his will. But then the writer says, in these last days. Now, the term last days is an interesting statement, an interesting question. What is meant by the last days? We often will look at three periods of history, divide up the entire history of mankind into three periods of history: the patriarchal period, the Mosaic period, and the Christian age, or the Christian period. The Jews would often just simply divide it into two sections, that which was before the Messiah and then the days of the Messiah. But the real question comes down, is the last days talking about the end of a particular era, or is it talking about the last era? And I think when we look particularly at chapter 9 and verse 26 of Hebrews, it would suggest that it's talking about that in the latter view. In chapter 9 and verse 26, it says, otherwise it would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. This is suggesting that these last days is simply talking about this last era of time. There's not going to be another era of time. There's not going to be another covenant. There's not going to be another kingdom, if you would. But this time, this is the culmination of what all God had been planning to bring about in its fruition in this time. And what is it in this time? Well, in this time, it says that God has spoken to us in his son. Now, that has lots of different meanings to it. Certainly the idea that Jesus is the one who has revealed these things. He is the messenger who has revealed this this message of God. The four Gospels are filled with the teaching of the Christ, teaching that even his own disciples had problem fully comprehending, understanding what it meant for them. And in fact, it wasn't until after his resurrection in Luke chapter 24 that we're told that Jesus opened their minds to understand the scriptures, to understand how all of these things were tied together. But Jesus is the one who revealed these things. But if that would be the only meaning of this term, speaks to us in his son, then what were the apostles? What were the New Testament prophets? What were the various teachers that are described in the book of Ephesians, chapter 4, beginning of verse 11? Because what we find here is a contrast between the many prophets and the many portions and the many ways, contrasting that with one. There is one prophet, but more than a prophet, as we're going to see. And there is one message, and there is one revealing of this message. And so when we say in his son, we need to recognize that it's more than just simply Jesus is the spokesman. Indeed, what we really find is that Jesus is the message itself. Now, I mentioned the respect the prophets had, even in the Old Testament, even from those who didn't want to hear them, they still respected them. And that's because they could see something of God in those prophets. They could see that these were men who were more than just simply messengers. And all the more so, we see that in the Messiah. We see that in the Son. He is more than just simply a messenger. In fact, he becomes the message himself. And that's why the writer here makes these next two statements, that he has appointed him as heir of all things. The prophets did not receive the things that they prophesied about. In fact, the writer of Hebrews is even make that point as we get to the end of chapter 11, that they didn't receive the message that they'd been prophesied about. But the writer here is going to point out that, in fact, the Son does receive. That's partly why he's called the Son, is that he is the appointed heir. He is the one who receives what this message is all about. The book of Romans in chapter 8 emphasizes this idea that that he and his disciples, us, are heirs of this kingdom that God has established. And then the last part of verse 2 says that he is also the one through whom he made the world. And we find this reference made in a number of places. The book of Colossians, for example, tells us that he made all things. 1 Corinthians emphasizes the idea that he made all things. It was significant. It was important to understand that the Son is also the Creator. The Gospel of John begins with this point in John chapter 1. He is the one who created this world. Nothing was created that was not created by him. And so this emphasizes the role of the Son. When you say he is the heir of all things, he's simply receiving that which, in fact, he had created himself. And so what we find here in Hebrews is the first of many contrasts. This is really a book of contrast. It's contrasting one against the other. What's interesting about that, when you look at contrast, we normally think of one that's bad, one that's good. But in the book of Hebrews, what we have is one that is good and one that is better. We have one that is honorable and one that has more honor. We have one that is glorious and one that has even more glory. And so when we look at this comparison between the prophets and the Son, in no way are we diminishing the prophets. Indeed, what we are doing is we are elevating the Son without diminishing the prophets in any way. And so the writer wants us to, at the very beginning, he wants us to understand that everything about what he has to say is something that is in, through, and is about the sun. Let me stop at that point and ask if anybody has any questions or comments.
Can you hear me, Eddie?
Mute yourself and
can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hey, Bob, I think that was you speaking. I can hear you.
The prophets. What word is translated as was in translated from?
The Greek word, I couldn't tell you. I'll be honest. I don't know Greek well enough to do that.
The reason I ask is Vicky's Bible has through, mine has in, but I have a electronic Bible.
Okay.
And it appears that the Greek words have been underscored in my Bible, and in is not one of the words that is underscored. To be exact, verse 1 reads from the underscored words, God spoke long ago prophets, many portions, many ways.
I do know that there are prepositions in Greek. I know one of the prepositions, and I think it's the one that's translated, that is normally translated as through, is dia, D-I-A. But in my, I use the New American Standard for my studies, and in the New American Standard, it has the same English preposition in both places. And it's not italicized, which my Bible uses for words that have been added by the translators that are not in the original. It uses italics, but this word has not been placed in italics. So I don't know the answer to that, Bob. I wish I could give you a better answer.
Okay.
Just looking it up real quick in a concordance, it does look like it's a word that can be in, by, or with.
Okay.
I think the King James might translate it by the prophets, but I still think that's probably consistent with your explanation.
Okay, I appreciate that, Adam. Thank you. Yeah, it's kind of hard for me to look it up electronically at this point, but I appreciate you doing that for us. Anybody else with any thoughts or comments in understanding the nature of how God has spoken and how important the Son himself is to that message. In fact, he really is the message. I think all of us are, of course, familiar with John 14 and verse 6, where Jesus, in answer to his apostles, when he talked about he was going away, and he said, you know the way I'm going. And he said, you know, we don't know the way. And he told them, I am the way. I am the truth, and I am the life. Emphasizing the fact that he himself personifies, he himself is that message. And that, I think, is the point that the writer here is really trying to emphasize. Where it was before in fractions, fragments, and delivered through a variety of different men or even animals, it's now focused on one. And it is focused on his son.
Yeah, brother, I think also the idea that you mentioned, and I'm glad you did, in these last days, I think it is based on chapter 9:26, excellent, excellent reference there, conveys the idea of reaching a goal. Yes. It is the consummation of all gone before. Some might even choose it as a theme. But to your good point about Jesus, already, brothers and sisters, we can see Jesus as prophet, priest, and king in those things that have been said about him. He's already revealed in those three roles, prophet, priest, and king.
Yes, absolutely. And that's just a side issue to the point that you make, Dempsey. Any of the premillennial type and doctrines and all the various flavors that it comes in, all of them miss this point. That this is the message. It's complete. There's nothing more that we're going to be looking for sometime in the future, that God's got yet another kingdom or another another covenant, another era of time. This is the culmination. This is everything he's been talking about, and it's brought to completion here. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Amen.
All right, let's move on now to verse 3. This is very important. I had a very long study with some Jehovah's Witnesses many years ago. And one of the things that's a vital tenet, a central tenet of what the Jehovah's Witnesses believe about Christ is the fact that he is a created God. Now, even the very concept of a created God is somewhat nonsensical, but this particular passage, it just completely shoots all kinds of holes into that idea. They believe that he was a created God who then in turn was given authority or power to be able to create all the other things. And in fact, that's the way they translate that passage when they said that nothing else was created. That's, they add the word else. Where the Bible just says nothing was created that was not created by him. They say nothing else was created that was not created by him. But notice what the writer says. He is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature. The term that is translated radiance here literally carries the idea of brilliance. It would be used to describe if you talk about the sun on a bright day where there's no clouds in the sky, the atmosphere is clear, and you would talk about how brilliant or how bright the sun is. Astronauts, they all of them, you know, made the same comment that when it went into orbit and when they could see the sun, it was a brilliance that they just had not experienced on Earth because of the effects of our atmosphere. That's the word that is used to describe the glory of the sun. He is the radiance of his glory. We'll talk about Moses next week, or I should say 2 weeks from now when we get into chapter 3. And we all remember the story where Moses was up on the mountain for 40 days in the presence of God receiving the covenant. And when he came back down to the people of Israel, we're told that his face was shining as bright as the sun. And this was just a reflection of the glory of God. And yet for a period of a month or more, Moses reflected this glory of God, if you would. Well, the term that is used here of Jesus is not that he was reflecting the glory of God, but in fact, he is radiating the glory of God. Much like if you would think about the difference between the sun and the moon. The sun is its own source of light. The moon reflects the light of the sun. The moon does not generate any light on its own, but it simply reflects the light of the sun. That's why the greater light is in the day and the lesser light is at night. That's the idea that we need to see here. Jesus, the sun, is the radiance of his glory. He's the brilliance of the glory of God. And then this next phrase, the exact image. The Greek word you would recognize is charakter, or as we transliterate it, character. When you talk about the character of somebody, what you're talking about is the essential features that make them who they are. Jesus is the exact representation of the nature of God. He's not a picture of God, not a copy of God, but he is in fact the exact image of God. Whatever would define God, we see in the Son. That's the point that the writer is trying to get us to understand. The term was actually used to describe a dye. If you remember in old days, even going up until the time of the Middle Ages, that the way that documents would be sealed, the way that someone who was trying to confirm that this came from me was with some sort of a wax seal. And they would take whatever document it is, roll it up, and then put a dab of hot wax on there. And then they would take their ring, their signet ring, and they would press that down into this wax. And that seal that was placed on there was an exact image of the ring. That's the term that is used here to describe the nature of Jesus, the nature of the Son. He's the exact image of the nature of God. And what else does it tell us about him? It says he upholds all things by the word of his power. This term uphold is really important for us to understand. When you think about a watchmaker, what does a watchmaker do? Well, with the skill that God has given him, the tools and the materials that have been provided, he can assemble a watch together. He can wind the spring up and then let the watch run on its own. And every time you wind up that spring, you give it the force, you give it the power to be able to run on its own. That is not the way this universe works. That's the part of the problem I think that we have is we think of God creating it in 6 days, resting the seventh day, then kind of flipping the switch, and now it's running on its own. This passage says just the opposite of that. The term that is translated upholds there is a continuous action. This is something that continues on. The Son is upholding. That might be a better way of us translating it. He is upholding all things by the word of his power. When you go back to Genesis chapter 1, how was the world created? What was the power that was used to create the world? Well, we remember by looking at every one of those passages, and it says, God said. It was, in fact, his word that made all things come into being. And so it should not surprise us. In fact, really, this is the only thing we could expect, that the Son is holding things together, that the Son is continuing to act. If we would to think of it as creation continuing, not creation from the sense that he's making anew, but creation in the sense that he is continuing the action that began at the beginning when he made from nothing, but he is continuing to keep that going by the word of his power. Then the last part of verse 3 says, when he had made purification of the sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. I'm reminded back of the sermon of Stephen in Acts chapter 7, when he was brought before the council and told to defend what he had been teaching. And he took them through the entire history of the Jews. And as he came to the conclusion of that, he came to the point where he convicted them of the sin of putting to death the Son, putting to death the Messiah. And as they drug him outside the city and were going to stone him to death, we're told that Stephen lifted up his eyes and he could see the vision of the Son at the right hand of God. That's the point that the writer here makes also. When he made this purification of sins, and we're going to come back to that thought in just a moment, he took his place at the right hand of the majesty on high. What does it mean to be a right-hand man? Well, a right-hand man is the most important aide, the one who is the strength of the one who is sitting on the throne. The right-hand man, the one who is his right hand, is the one who is his strength. And so that's what we see about the Son, is he has sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. So what does that mean? Look, I went ahead of myself there. It means that he has a name. In verse 4 says, having become as much better than the angels as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. Well, what is the name? Well, the name is the name that the writer has already given him. The Son. he has been given this name above all names. I think we have that song in our songbook, Name Above All Names. The name ultimately is that he is the Son. We're going to look in just a moment in Psalm chapter 2, but that is what God declares about him. You are my Son. And so this is how he is better than the angels. We've already seen he is better than the prophets, and in no way does that diminish the prophets. But now the writer is going on to show us that he is also better than the angels. And again, in no way does this diminish the angels. What this is doing is elevating the Son above the angels. Let me pause at that point and see if there's anybody with any questions or comments down through verse 4.
The fact that he sat down, Eddie.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, brother, the fact that he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high indicates a finished work. Mm-hmm. He made purification of sin and sat down at the right hand. So it's a finished work. You know, contrary to our Catholic friends that talk about something ongoing. Mm-hmm. This is a finished work. He died one time for all. And so the results of that good work are now available, you know, to all those who would come to the Son. But it's a finished work.
Excellent point, Dempsey. I appreciate that. And that's one of the significant things in this study is to look at the verb tenses. There are things that are ongoing. The upholding the creation. It is an ongoing thing. This creation continues by the mighty hand of the Son. But you're absolutely right. The purification is a done deal. It's not something that he has to continually die over and over again. He died one time for all time. And in fact, the writer of Hebrews is going to make that point later on when we get into talking about the sacrifices. Anybody else with any thoughts or comments? All right, let's pick up here then in verse 5. Now, what the writer is going to do, as I mentioned earlier, he's going to start taking the various fragments, the things that were spoken through the prophets long ago. And what he's going to do is kind of take like a jigsaw puzzle, and he's going to take all these pieces and start putting them together. And when he puts them all together, what we're going to see is the picture of what God's plan was from before the foundation of the world. Proverbs chapter 8 tells us that the wisdom of God claims that God had known her since before the foundation of the world, that God had had this plan already in place. And what our writer here, what our author is going to do is take all these jigsaw pieces and put it all together so that we can see this picture that God has for us. So starting here in verse 5, we find the first of these Old Testament quotations. This comes from Psalm chapter 2 and in verse 7. And just as a sidelight, if you would think of this is a lesson I learned many, many years ago, back when I was in college, one of the best Bible teachers that I ever had. He taught that there are 5 chapter 2s in the Bible that we need to memorize and recognize that they are all a thread that comes together. The first one is Psalms chapter 2, which we're looking at right now. You also look at Isaiah chapter 2, and I think Dempsey mentioned this in one of his sermons just a couple of weeks ago. Daniel chapter 2, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And finally, Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2 talks about in the last days. And all those 4 Old Testament chapter 2s are fulfilled in the New Testament in Acts chapter 2. And so if you could kind of just think of that, you know, take your hand and think of those 4 Old Testament chapter 2s, and then the thumb is Acts chapter 2. These things all tie together. They all have to do with the kingdom that God had prophesied. So here in Psalm chapter 2, we find it begins talking about the nations that have conspired in their rage against God, that they're going to overthrow the, the realm of God. But here in verse 7, he says, I will tell the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. What does it mean to be begotten? Let me go back there just a moment. What does it mean to be begotten? Again, I mentioned the studies of the Jehovah's Witnesses a year ago. They use this verse as proof that that Jesus was created at some point. They say God gave birth to Jesus at some point. The problem is this is Psalm chapter 2, which is written many, many years after the creation of the world, and many years after the time when when Jesus was the one who created the world. And yet in this psalm is a prophecy. It says, today I have begotten you. There's a particular day in which he is described as being begotten. In fact, we find as we go on through that psalm, it talks about establishing him on Zion. The begotten of Jesus did not occur when he was born into this world. That occurred in Bethlehem. It certainly didn't occur sometime before the foundation of the world so that he could be born, so that he could create the world. But in fact, it had to do something with Mount Zion. And we get further into the book of Hebrews, that will become very clear what we're talking about. But let me just simply make the point now. This is talking about his resurrection. This is talking about how Jesus overcame death. From that, God established him on his throne. And that is how we can say, in the sense that he was begotten, he was established to be the king. That's the point that the psalmist is trying to get us to understand. And that's the first point that our writer of Hebrews begins with in trying to show us how that Jesus is superior to the angels. He asks the question, which of the angels did God ever say this to? And my final reference to the Jehovah's Witnesses teaching, the other thing they believe is that Jesus is, in fact, Michael, the archangel of the Old Testament. If that be true, then, in fact, the writer of Hebrews didn't understand that Jesus was an angel. He's trying to say Jesus is superior to the angels. But he asks the question, which of the angels did God ever say this to? It's a rhetorical question, meaning he didn't say it to any of them. He said it to his son. And he established him on his throne. We're going to see that none of the angels ever had a throne. The next passage that we look at is found in the last part of verse 5. And again, I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. This comes from, let me get my other passage over here. This comes from 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 14. It's a fascinating passage because this is a passage that had a literal application that occurred within the lifetime of the people who this was written to, but it has a further and deeper application that the writer of Hebrews is now showing to us. You think again about that puzzle piece. There may be some aspects, something that you can kind of recognize on that puzzle piece by itself. It might give you a little bit of a picture of what's going on. But then when it's assembled into the entire puzzle and you can see how it fits into everything, you see the broader picture. This passage from 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 14 is a prophecy to David. This is the time when David had decided that he wanted to build a house for God because he lived in a beautiful house of cedar and God was still dwelling in a tent. And David said that wasn't right to him, that the ark of God should dwell in the tent while he was living in a magnificent house. And so he decided, and Nathan told him, that's a great idea. Yes, absolutely. You build a house for God. And God was telling him, said, wait a minute, nobody asked me. And he said, before you build me a house, I'm going to build your house. And God here was prophesying about how he was going to establish the house of David to be perpetual rulers of his people. And specifically, God prophesies, you will have a son, and I will be to your son a father. He shall be to me a son. And he goes on to talk about how that God was going to raise up Solomon That was the immediate application of what we find there in 2 Samuel chapter 7. God was going to raise up Solomon to be the king, and God was going to discipline and train Solomon. But of course, the writer of Hebrews has now taken that passage that we would think of as applying to Solomon, and he has applied it to the son. And we're going to see that, in fact, the son will also be trained. The word disciplined, we need to understand, means this idea of training. He is going to be trained. He is going to be made perfect. That's something we'll come to later as we go through the study, but I just want to, we talked about that a little bit last week, and I just want to mention it again here, how that fits in with this idea of Solomon, that he is going to be trained to be the son, to be the perfect son. Then we come to verse 6. The writer says, and again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all the angels of God worship him. Now, we find back in the book of Colossians, chapter 3, that angels had, or chapter 2, that angels had been worshipped even by people in the first century. Paul, writing to the Colossians, was concerned about that happening even within the church there in Colossae, that there were some who were teaching this idea that they should worship angels. And Paul is telling them, don't be disqualified by someone who's trying to teach you to do that. Just like it happened in the Old Testament, just like it happens in New Testament time, just like it happens even today, there are people who look at these spirit beings, these angelic creatures, and we think of them as being something that we should worship. We find John did so even in the book of Revelation. When he was shown these visions by this angel, he fell down to worship. And the angel says, no, you do not worship me. You are to worship the Son and to worship him only. So here the writer of Hebrews tells us that we are to, that all of the angels are to worship him. This comes from Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 43, and specifically the Septuagint version of that. If you're looking at a translation that's translated from the Hebrew, you won't find this this clause in here, let all the angels of God worship. But it is found in the Septuagint translation of the Bible. So I've got a copy of the Septuagint translation there for you on the screen. And that's what the writer of Hebrews was quoting from. He says, let all the angels of God worship him. And so all the angels, including Michael, including Gabriel, all of them are to worship the Son. And so this prophet that Moses had talked about, the one that would rise up, that would be like him, ultimately Moses is telling us this is God's plan. And then in verse 7, he switches from talking about the Son to talking about the angels themselves. What were their role? If they were not to be worshipped, then what was their role? What was their duty? Part of that comes from understanding the word angel itself. The word angel is another transliterated Greek word, angelos, but it's essentially angel is the way we would transliterate it. It literally just means a messenger or minister. And so when we find this talking about the angels, he makes his messengers, or he makes his angels winds, his ministers or his angels are flaming fire. Their job was to minister, to serve. And we're going to see at the very end of this chapter that, in fact, they were to serve us. They were not to be objects of worship for us, but in fact, they are servants for us. But here we find that it said he makes his angels winds. This quotation comes from Psalm 104 and in verse 4. So again, here's another puzzle piece that the writer has assembled into the puzzle. In contrast to that, what do we find about the Son? We find the Son is to be worshipped. We find the Son has an eternal kingdom, an eternal throne. Taken here from Psalm 45 and verses 6 and 7. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Now, you might say, well, this is God. This is someone prophesying about God. But notice here it says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of righteousness, uprightness. Dempsey mentioned, I think it was 2 weeks ago from Genesis 49, about Jacob had prophesied about his sons and made this very statement about Judah, that the scepter would not depart from Judah. It says, your scepter is a scepter of uprightness. You've loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God. Now notice here, he's writing to God, your throne, O God. But then he says about him, your God has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions. And so we find here, I don't want to say two gods, but two beings that are God. We find two beings that both can be described, both of them can be quoted as being God. This is what God has done for God. This is not something that is said about the angels, but in fact, it is said about the Son. Also, as we look in Psalm 102 and beginning of verse 25, of old you laid the foundation of the earth. The heavens are the work of your hands. Again, emphasizing the fact that the Son is the creator. They perish, but you will remain. They all wear out like a garment. You change them like a robe. They will pass away, but you are the same and your years have no end. He is eternal. The one who has the power to create, by the very nature of having the power to create, logically makes him to be eternal. If he can create life from nothingness, if he can create, take that which doesn't exist and make something out of that, then it stands to logic the fact that he can never die. He can never cease to exist himself. Because he has within himself the innate power to create, to give, to make life. And so that's the logical argument that the writer here is making. And what he's saying is the Son is superior because of this power that he has to overcome all. And yet another quotation here, taken from Psalm 110. We have to move my screen a little bit here. Yeah, Psalm 110 and verse 1, one of the most important messianic psalms. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Again, we find God speaking to God. We find divinity speaking to divinity. This is what I'm going to do for you. Sit at my right hand. Dempsey's already talked about the fact that this his work of redemption is done. We can notice, I didn't put it on the screen, but Paul uses this argument to talk about the idea that that Jesus is sitting at the right hand until the final enemy is defeated, that enemy being death. Now, he has already overcome death himself, but for the purpose of defeating death entirely and completely for all. And he sits at the right hand of God until that final victory over death. Anybody with any thoughts or questions then of what we have talked about here in chapter 1? To summarize it, we have essentially two statements of the superiority of the Son. He is superior to the prophets. He is superior to the angels. What we have to understand is the prophets and the angels were extremely important in the revealing of the message of God, specifically the covenant of Moses. And that's what we're going to start with in chapter 2 next week. Does anybody have any questions or comments then about what we have covered today? All right, let me give you some thoughts, some questions for you to consider for next week. These are four questions that I think will help to summarize the points that I really want to emphasize when we get into chapter 2. First question, how had the audience, the intended audience of this book, how had they received the word of salvation? In other words, what did they know about how they themselves had accepted this word of salvation? How had they been saved? That's important. The writer is going to use that as a keystone argument in leading them to the next point that he's going to make. Secondly, as we drop down to verse 8 of chapter 2, the very last part of verse 8, the writer says, but now we do not yet see all things subjected to him. What had not yet been subjected to the Christ at the time he wrote this letter? And I think that's a significant point for us to understand the writing of Hebrews, both as it applied to the people that it was initially written to, and also as we are to understand it ourselves. The third question, why is it fitting? That just means the idea of appropriate. I remember the old movie Gone with the Wind, and there was one point where one woman was talking about the way another woman was dressing, and talking about that she says it's just not fitting for her to dress that way. But fitting means something that's appropriate. The writer here says in verse 10, it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, through whom all things, and bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the author of their salvation through suffering. Why was it appropriate to perfect Jesus through suffering? I want you to think about that question. And then finally, taken from verse 17, therefore he had to be made like his brethren in all things. Why was it necessary for Jesus to become human? I want us to kind of step back a little bit and think about, could God have used a different method of saving his people? Was it really necessary that Jesus had to become human? Was it really necessary that Jesus died? That's a very powerful thought consideration for us to keep in mind. I know the answer is yes, but more importantly, why is the answer yes? And I think that's a very sobering thought for us. It's a very powerful thought as we go through the remainder of the book, as we look at this message. I want us to always keep that in mind. This was necessary. And why was it necessary? That's the important point we need to consider. Well, I appreciate everybody's attention. And sorry about the problem there at the beginning where I apparently accidentally muted myself, but hopefully we got through the rest of the class okay. Anybody with any thoughts or comments before we conclude our class? All right. Well, thank you, everybody. And we'll look forward to seeing everybody on Wednesday. Have a good evening.
Thanks a lot, Eddie.